promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Ponds family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and curly stands, the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Friesian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to know a secret? The Massachusetts Breeding Program pays huge bonuses for finishing first, second, or third at any racetrack in the country. You didn't know that, did you? Massbreds get paid up to an additional 25% of their purse earnings for the owner, and breeder, and stallion owner, and developer. It's the best-kept secret in racing, till now. Tell all your friends, and to learn more, visit massbreds.com.
Would you believe that champions weren't measured by rings, but by a crown? That the history books were written on dirt? That the greatest of all time was a horse?
He is running like a tremendous machine.
Experience the magic at this year's Belmont Stakes as we honor the 50th anniversary of Secretariat's legendary Triple Crown triumph. Join the celebration at Belmont Park on Saturday, June 10th. Tickets on sale now at Belmont.
Sirius XM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
Case, are we back? Is that I'm sitting here talking to the boys, and I love it. I think we are right. Casey, are we back? Casey's going to be annoyed at me because I completely missed the break because I'm talking here to Sandy and to Jason Milligan, and I guess we got to have the same conversation that we were having off air. Jason, of course, director of racing, and it's good to see you.
Good to see you as usual.
I love coming here, and this was good. This was the window for Rebel. The one thing that I talked to Clint about it, you got to stop the. Every Saturday I look up, and it's a wet track every time I look up. It's crazy.
It's been a very wet January and February. I can't remember one like this.
Well, it doesn't take away from the racing. I mean, the racing, you know, there's no off the turf.
No.
So you don't have to worry about that.
No, like I said, it's like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, it rains, and then we try to dry out through the weekend, and it's like we repeat the process. I mean, it's been ongoing. So, but hats off to the track crew. They've done a great job. The track seems like it's in great shape. Sounds good right now. Excuse me. Horses are training, and you don't hear them on the track. So I think we our track man and track crew deserve a great deal of applause.
Nice. Well, and especially under the conditions, it's been a safe meet too.
It's been safe meet, very safe meet.
Yeah.
So,
not many horses that have broke down.
No. We're very blessed. Like I said, obviously the new protocols. Everyone's, you know, I think taking a closer look. So, but like I said, I mean, you know, the way the races have come up the last couple of weeks here with allowance races on Saturdays, you know, last week with the Razorback, that was an outstanding race card. This Saturday, looking at the Rebel, another outstanding card. So, full fields and many wagering opportunities.
Yeah, we talked with Clinton about what he's working on, this new farm, this Leadham Farms, and the Arkansas bred races, and you've been particularly utilizing these maiden specials at the end of the card. And I think initially, for horse players, they were the Arkansas breds. Well, how do you? But they've actually been. I know we had the crazy price the other day.
Yes,
when Moquette ran off the board at 1-5, but it's actually been somewhat formful. They haven't been inscrutable for the most part.
For the most part,
Sandy, I'm having trouble with that audio. I don't know what. Hold on here. Let me see this for a second.
I'll say I think that over the last probably three, 4 years, I think the breeding has also improved within the Arkansas bred categories as well. We're starting to see more connections. Even breeding to some Kentucky stallions and bringing them the mares back here. So, like I said, I think the trajectory for the Arkansas breeding program is on a good path as well.
Everything that Clinton had to say, and Sandy, I think when Clint went over there to watch his filly work, he pulled the cord out. So try that again.
I think I'm good now.
Yeah, you are.
There we go.
We can't deny the listening audience Sandy's insights.
Technology's great when it works.
Exactly. No, I was excited for what he's got going. The other thing that because I know that Mr. Sella doesn't come in till tomorrow, but I thought, oh, I'd probably be able to stay at the hotel. Couldn't stay at the hotel. The hotel was
booked
up solid with conventioneers visiting town.
Yeah, this week was a week where when we closed Sunday racing, we had a group of conventions actually come in Sunday night. They left Tuesday afternoon. We had another convention come in Tuesday evening, and I think they leave to check out tonight or tomorrow morning. It's kind of what the vision was when we built the hotel and the event center, and it's starting to pick up the off-day business and, to be more of a actual appeal every day, not just the weekends.
I was a little surprised.
Well, plus it was Rebel Weekend, too. So, Rebel Weekend, you're going to get extra people in for that week as well.
I was talking to a person downstairs that came in to watch her horse breeze, and she said she had to get right out of here. She couldn't even stay. I'm sure it's for the Rebel. I have some friends of mine that are leaving Louisville this morning. They're on their way now. They're coming down. There's a real draw to Oakland, and especially I think this weekend with the Derby prep, people are ready for this thing to get rolling closer to Derby.
It sure felt like to be honest, you put $1 million up, and this has been a rich race anyway.
Yes.
$750 for a good long period. So you put up that kind of money, you expect to get high quality types that
full fields and people that are on that path.
Pat has a really good card for Saturday. It's loaded. I mean, you'll have plenty of opportunities to make some money if you can pick the winners.
I also somebody asked me an interesting question about the number of sprint races and what the it's just kind of interesting. I mean, we have what? We have six in a row? Five in a row? Five in a row.
No, I haven't even looked that far at it. So,
five in a row. It's just unusual, too. There's an allowance in the fifth that starts that middle pick five. Then three-year-old filly maiden special weight, six. The carousel, the fillies and mares going six. Second-level allowance going six. Two second-level allowances, actually.
Back-to-back.
They split with that race?
No, I think one's
conditional.
I think one's fillies and mares, one's open, I think. But I'm not positive.
No, they're both males.
Okay.
They're both the field of 9 and 10. So they must have split it up. Unbelievable.
Yeah, like I said, the Honeybee came up strong. So, when that's one thing we've been watching around the country, the 3-0 filly races have relatively been short fields. So
that's true.
For us to get 11 in here, I was very pleased with that.
Well, and listen, you got Brad Cox on hand. Brad Cox will do wonders for your entry box.
Steve Ashmussen always helps too.
It's true. You were ready. You know, it's funny. We were in New Orleans on Saturday, and there was the potential for Asmussen to break the 10,000 mark.
Yes.
And everybody was watching, and you had to watch Sam Houston. You had to watch over here, over at Oakland, and you had to watch over here. And he got up to 99.99, and didn't get there. And
early Friday, it got to 9.99.
Okay.
Early Saturday.
Early Saturday.
My days were mixed up.
There you go. Early Saturday, because everybody at the fairgrounds was hopeful that whenever you get these milestones, every racetrack, right?
Mm-hmm.
They all want to be the one. And the funniest part is they've all got to make the signs.
Sure.
So everybody's got these congratulations, Steve. Yeah. And it's Saratoga. Last summer, when he broke the
all-time win,
yeah, mm-hmm. And they were hopeful that it was going to be a significant horse,
right.
at a big race.
Yeah,
it's kind of funny.
Yeah, I was talking with Frank Hoff at Sam Houston, yeah. Because we're like bantering back and forth. He goes, "Not here, it's on you." And, so like we were going back and forth because I couldn't watch the Sam Houston races. So
that's right.
Yeah,
nobody would. Oh my God, I hadn't even thought of that. Nobody would have seen it.
Yeah, so no, everybody had like pay up the $5 on HRN TV, to get the stream of Sam Houston, basically, if you wanted to watch it. So Frank was ready with a sign at Sam Houston. So to your point, I imagine Fairgrounds was ready with a sign, and we were ready with a sign. So it was neat to have him do it here, especially with his family all here, because that was at Saturday. He was at Fairgrounds,
right?
But his wife and kids were here.
Just in case they were gonna win.
Yeah.
Well, and that is nice then that he got to be that they got to be there.
Family together.
Well, there was an interesting city. You can weigh in on this. There was speculation. Some people said, "Well, that'll never happen. Nobody will ever get that many wins again."
I told Steve when I ran into his son. He was taking the sign out to the car, and I ran into his son, and I told him, I said, there won't be many more of those signs. The 10,000,
crazy number.
Think about what he's done to do that as well. I mean, with all the different divisions that he has and the different racetracks that he goes to, he goes everywhere. I mean, any place you look up, you're liable to see four or five Asmussen horses in during the year, whether it be Sam Houston or Remington or
Delta Downs. He plays on all the levels.
And what's amazing is when he's on with me and obviously and with anybody, and all of the horsemen who operate that extensively, that widely, you can name any horse I bring up with him that either ran or is going to run. And it does not matter if it's a 10 claimer or if it's one of the biggest names in the barn for Winchell or Stone Street. He knows
where they're at.
Not just where they're at.
He knows who they are
and what they've been doing.
Yes.
And I asked him when he set that record. We had that. I didn't reach for him for this 10,000. I mean if I had him on every time there was one of these milestones. But I did ask him how he does that. And he said, for me, it's easy. He said, you should ask my father, who has to keep track of 1,000 mares and foals in fields and knows every one. Mm-hmm. He said, that's where he got it. And I mean, and Brad Cox is the exact same way. I mean, it will tell you about the workouts. We'll tell you about how horse is doing. Missed a couple of days. I mean, you got to be kidding. With 600, 500, however many horses, it's an amazing mental capacity.
Well, even trainers that are in the grandstand watching workouts right now, they see a horse, they know exactly what horse it is and for what trainer. I mean, they've got just a different eye.
Especially those guys that have been raised in it, like right. Steve. Randy Morris is the same way. You can look at a horse, you can see a horse, and it might not. Phil Oswald, that works for Sally now, was the same way. Those guys see a horse. They might not see him for two or three years. They see him again. I don't know how they do it, but they say, well, that's old so-and-so. Where's he been, you know? But Steve, one afternoon, several years ago, we were at Churchill, and he was out there, and he was going through these horses. I said, hey, Steve, and he knew them when they were walking up the shed row, which one is which. He's got no binder in front of him or no list with the horses. I said, how do you know that? He said, that's, you know, my dad raised us that way. We better know who they are. And that's something that amazes me. I've been an identifier. And still, I wouldn't know horses when they walked up to me, one from the other, if it wasn't for the lip tattoo at the time. They were using lip tattoos, and I wouldn't know who they were. But these guys are, I mean, they're pretty good at it.
Well, when you would be up in the clocker stand with Clocker John and with Pete Vestal and
John Robertson,
John sees them come up the gap. He doesn't even need. You know, the gap attendant to tell him who's coming on the track. And the girls, I've said this before, the girls that work with the TV, like when Breeders' Cup comes to a town, you've got those girls that there might be 30, 40 horses on the track galloping, and they're not looking at the saddle cloth numbers. They're identifying them based on stockings and on stars and snips. And it's the most amazing thing you'll ever see or hear.
Yeah. Those guys are really talented at what they did, and I guess it's a learning process. And I always say, just like if you were going to play golf or you were going to play basketball or whatever, the younger you learn to do something, the better off you are, because for some reason it sticks in your mind.
Unbelievable.
You develop habits early when you're young like that, and it'll stay with you throughout. But these guys, when they look at these horses coming up the gap, and they'll say, well, that's so and so, and it won't even be their, it's not even their horse, but they know who it is because they've seen them in the paddock.
Well, what about when it comes to transport and particularly young horses that in some cases don't have names? I had a horse actually get misshipped one time. Ended up missing, supposed to get off at some place, and ended up all the way down in South Carolina. But how does it work for the
companies? We use tags. We put a halter tag in their halters that'll have all the information on them. Generally, their name or their breeding, if it's a younger horse like that, and then the person that sent the horse, like say it's from here, and it'd be Danny Pites, and he's going to Churchill to. Brad Cox. I mean, those are on the halter tag, and you slip them in their halter, and then when they get to the next town, when they go to unload them, they take those tags off. And some of them have names on, but we try not to depend on the names on the halters.
Those can be
because,
wrong.
Because those can be wrong. They
sure.
can change halters on them, but we put tags on them and make sure they're identified. There's still things that get mixed up, and there's still things that get mixed up from a farm. A farm might put a horse on there and be under the impression that it's so-and-so, and it wasn't so-and-so. It was somebody else. Those mistakes happen, but... these guys that recognize these horses, that's a real talent. That's a real talent.
Unbelievable. Sandy Montgomery with us, Jason Milligan as well, and, of course, Sandy with Sally Van Company, and one of the real characters around the game that make it so special and so much fun. And I'm going to end up letting you down if I cannot. Shug, we had dinner with Shug and Allison and John Parada and Maggie and also Herb Oster, and we went to Tropical Acres down in Dania, and Shug, your name came up, and Shug told a story, and I'm Sandy,
I might be better off that you can't recall that.
No, it was a healthy story. It wasn't the kind that can't be told on the air.
Yeah,
but well, Did you work for Shug at any time?
No, I never worked for Shug, so to say, but when I was hustling a jock, I took care of doing most of his entries and nominating his horses to different stakes around town or around the country. But I never did actually work for him. I was a stable agent, and kind of what you can call it. But Shug and I have been friends, have had a good relationship for many years. And it didn't start there, but it led to that. And Shug was on quite a roll there when he was younger. And that's what we did. We just, I'd see a stake be Fairmont Park. We went to Fairmont.
Thank you. Were you from Ellis
to Fairmont?
That's the story, Sandy.
Yeah.
That's the story.
Well, we don't want to tell the whole story, but we went over there. I had a jock at the time. He was an Arkansas native called Travis Hightower, and we were riding at Ellis, and Shug had, I'll tell you who it was Queen of Song. He was a really, really nice mare for Parrish Hill. And Moon and Shug had drove to Ellis. They had a horse in at Ellis. They left there and went over. And then after the jock got done, we went over. And the horse won. She won by nose. I'll never forget it. It was Queen of Song. And the horse that she beat was a pretty good horse that a guy by the name of Paul Dargene at the time that was training in Illinois. That was a really good guy. And Queen of Song went by about a nose, and Travis came back and said, we knew we had it all away. I knew I had it all away, and it's like, wow, well, you sure? But it was quite a road trip from Ellis to Fairmont.
Well, tell everybody about Moon.
Moon is Donnie Gamble, who actually is the reason I started working for Sally. He's been working for Sally for years, but Moon has a reputation on the racetrack. If you say something, Moon said this or Moon did this, but Moon's a racetracker.
How did he get the nickname Moon?
That I can't tell you. I've always known him as Moon.
Everybody knows him as Moon.
I know he's Donnie Gamble, but I've always known him as Moon. That's just what that's been forever.
Shug talked about the drive and weather, bad weather.
Yeah.
I think he for whatever reason, the trip from Ellis from Evansville down to Collinsville was an adventure. They slept in the car.
They left in the night. They left and got there. They left after the races. So they had to get there in the evening, and I don't want to speak for them. They may have slept in the car.
I think they slept in the car.
And then the next morning, we drove over, because Travis had rode at the was riding at Ellis at the time.
Unbelievable.
That's quite a story now.
And clearly everybody...
I'm going to tell you something else about that story. I'm not so sure this is not right. I think Indian Charlie was the groom.
In fact, you're 100% correct.
Indian Charlie and Phil both worked for Shug. Like I say, I never did because I was past the grooming stage at that time, and I'd been the identifier here, and then the second year here, I started testing a jock's book.
How long did you do that? How long did you work the as a jock agent?
25 years.
Probably. That long?
Yeah. Yeah, let's see. I probably started in early 80s. Maybe 20 years. At least 20 years. I started in 81. I was here as identifier in 80 and 81. I started hustling jock in 81, and I kept hustling jock up to about 2000.
Give everybody the list of jocks you had at one time.
Well, I've had Travis Hightower. He was my first one. And at the same time, I had a kid named Tony Marino. And then I had Pat Johnson. I had Charlie Woods. I've worked for Early Fires. I had a jock here one year that really did well, Jose Martinez Jr. He did really well. Randy Romero, I had him at one time. I mean, But I pretty much stuck close to the jocks that I had for quite a while. Pat Johnson and his brother Joe, I had him too when he was an apprentice. But I stuck pretty close to those guys. We had a long, long 10-12 year
hitches.
Yeah.
Didn't you have Otto Thorworth when he started?
No, I didn't have Otto Thorworth when he started. I had him at one time at Churchill. But he was like a second. I don't mean to demean this, but he was like my second rider when I had Pat. And you could have now these guys got 8 or 10 riders. At the time, you could only have two. One,
the Santos kid has rewritten rewritten the whole rule book.
So
I don't think he may like COVID more than him.
Exactly,
because that's when his whole career changed.
Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing to be able to keep up with all those different racetracks in the books, and not only that, but the people that are at those racetracks, you know. But you start, you have to have a nucleus, and I think he starts maybe with Broberg on one side, and then, you know, he's got quite a bit of business here.
Yeah.
But I don't know how they keep up with all of it.
He's,
but
he's a bright, young kid.
He is. You know, he went to Bellarmine and played soccer there in Louisville.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and he was an announcer for the basketball games at Bellarmine when Scotty Davenport first came there. Maybe even when Bob Valvano.
Wow.
He played soccer, but then he worked on the basketball broadcast too.
I love that.
Yeah, he's really a talented
he
kid.
Was always,
really,
even when he was tailing around his dad, Jose Santos, he was always one of those kids that you could just tell, you know, had a future. I mean, he was inquisitive and he was smart and you know, listen, racetrack kids have an unusual upbringing and an advantage because they're around adults in a much different fashion than, you know, the non-racetrackers. They're exposed to, you know, sort of a bigger universe of experience than other children.
One of the things I really thought I was lucky at, I was a real young guy when I first started hustling a jocks book, and there weren't many young people doing it at the time. They were mostly older guys. But these older guys took up with me for some reason. Guys like Paul Blair that had early fires for so long. Bob Bates that was an agent for Tim Ducey and also was a Hall & Smith band man. I was really lucky with my relationship with Donnie Richardson, too. Of course, that goes to a different story. That's more when I got involved in the racing office. But those guys kind of led me in the right direction.
Doc Danner.
Well, Doc's not really that much older than me. Now,
back then he was older.
Yeah. But those guys were older guys, and they really did, especially when I went to Chicago and worked at Arlington and Hawthorne. And no, I don't know why. I mean, I didn't know those guys when I first showed up there, but those guys couldn't have been any nicer to me. And like I say, young guys weren't hustling much at that time. It was mostly older fellas that had been around the racetrack and had developed relationships with trainers that you rode for trainers back then more than they do now. I mean, they still do, obviously, but back then you were mostly tied up with an outfit, and those guys would... Here he comes.
McQuette making his way in. What has changed, Sandy, in your view of it? Or has it really, I mean, obviously there's this new era that just came upon us with the, you know, the way they're using the Zoom system, so that's a little different. But those guys are still, they still have to hang around the racetrack. They still have to, you know what horses are on the grounds and what, you know, where they want to get their jocks, the mounts they want to get their jocks. So that part is still part of it. But has that part of the game changed to your view?
Not a whole lot.
No.
Not a whole lot. The only difference is what Joe Santos is doing, and that's working three or four different racetracks.
Right.
That's different. But when you mostly followed a circuit, you know, like in Kentucky, we'd go from Churchill to Ellis to Turfway or Latonia at the time. And you mostly followed a circuit. So, and you mostly followed whoever you were riding for. John Lively and those kind of guys, when they used to ride around here, they had people they rode for, and they were dedicated, or what's the word I'm looking for? They were loyal. They were loyal to those guys.
There you go.
You get beat. The jock might come back and say, "Hey, I rode a bad race on that horse." Well, you and they say, "Well, that's all right. We'll get them the next time," because they were all friends. The relationships that people had on the racetrack is the biggest change. In my opinion, now there's a lot of people out there that cut your throat.
Exactly. Not that there weren't those back then either. But I will say also, it does seem like is there more? I don't want to call it interference, but is there more input from
Owners
and stable managers?
You didn't have all that.
No, you didn't, did you?
You didn't have, like we were talking earlier about Asmussen and Brad Cox and Todd Pletcher, you didn't have those kind of, people had 20 horses, 30 horses, that's what they had, that's what they had to work with. But the internet has changed racing too, because now it used to be you'd have to be at the races to see a race. I mean, you didn't turn it up on your... You didn't pull it up on the...
Jason, thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate you being here.
Always
come
a pleasure.
Come back and visit anytime. Sorry, I got to jump out.
You're an executive. You got work to do. We'll actually get Ron Moquette to sit in on this conversation, too. And Moquette, I'm sure, has got some thoughts about the owner involvement and I think I see Randy Moss making his boy. This is really the Hot Springs royalty wandering through.
Wow,
Randy Moss, yeah.
Well, no, we got Moquette. We got them all.
Here.
No, did he just wander up here? What did you do?
Wandered up here.
You're unbelievable.
Off the also elder.
What's going on? Steve, how are you?
Randy Moss jumps in.
This is actually a live mic.
I was going to say you got Sandy Montgomery here as well.
Seen Sandy in forever.
The hometown.
Oh my God!
Are you in for broadcast or what? Are you
doing? Just here to see family. We had a little family reunion scheduled, and figure what the hell, if you're going to do that, you might as well do it on Rebel weekend, right?
Look at you.
So it's not very often I get to go to a racetrack and just kick back, and I don't have to wear a tie and put on freaking makeup, and so it's nice. And I haven't been here in 4 years probably. Hot Springs.
It's
pre-COVID.
What, there hasn't been a broadcast there?
No.
You were doing stuff from the studio as well.
So this, I mean, the hotel, it's like, for someone who's born and raised here, you would have never, ever imagined. Sandy's been here forever, too.
Yeah.
That Oakland would look like this
Yeah, you've seen it through when it was really good in the early 80s or even longer for you than that.
70s.
But I came in the 80s when I came. Yeah, and then to see what happened and then to see it like it is now, it's quite a turn. It's pretty good, really.
So I was born and raised here.
Right.
And I used to sneak in, illegally sneak into the racetrack and with the assistance of the Holthuses and the Irwins at times. And one of my earliest memories, Steve, there used to be, this is way back in the day, this is late 60s, early 70s, there used to be a cluster of barns on the other side of Central Avenue. And just like Saratoga, they would stop the traffic.
Oh, my God.
And horses would come across the street to train. And one of my earliest memories was just sitting on Central Avenue and waiting for the horses and watching the horses walk by. and crossing from one side of Central Avenue over to the racetrack side to train.
That yeah. That had to be a fiasco.
Well, Central Avenue was not what it is now, right? The south part of Hot Springs was not nearly as built up as it is now, so you didn't have as much vehicle traffic as you do. But, yeah, they used to have probably 6-8 barns over there, you know.
Yeah, when I first came here, when you went south of, I guess Golf Links, you had the Kmart over there and you had the Kroger. Beyond that, and it wasn't at Humphreys Dairy? Wasn't that?
Yeah, that's where I lived, way back out there, and there was very little.
That was
there.
All countryside.
Yeah. It was all.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'd get to Mrs. Miller's. That's about the next place you'd see that, wasn't it, Randy?
Yeah.
That was before the mall. I mean, I was here before the mall.
So basically between here and Lake Hamilton was?
Farmland. Very little. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Tulane.
Yeah, Tulane Road. Steve, in the summers, I used to get on my bicycle, and I would ride down Central Avenue to Oaklawn because there was a little drugstore across the street called Crawford Drug that was the closest place to buy a racing form. And I used to get on my bike and ride, and I'd be riding down the center line, down Central Avenue. There'd be no cars.
Unbelievable.
Early morning, you know, yep. and ride my 10 speed and come out and buy a racing form and then turn around and pedal back.
Unbelievable. It would be a fun. Have you ever sat with Andy Serling, who grew up in Saratoga, and juxtaposed, growing up, in
there's so many
in
similarities.
Town? Yeah. I mean, it's.
Got the racetrack in the middle of town.
Yep.
God, they're both called the Spa. They both had thermal baths, springs, Saratoga Springs, hot springs. Yeah, as someone who's born and raised here, I've said this a few times, and I feel guilty about saying it because I don't want to denigrate Hot Springs. When I say that Hot Springs was just like a less affluent Saratoga. Right.
Although, at one time, the difference, the what sustained Saratoga was the college, and having Skidmore there, and the fact of its proximity to basically be a bedroom community for Albany, gave it that bridge from when gaming, basically when the gaming got busted. And because there was a very bad period that you had here in Hot Springs, you did have in Saratoga. And when I got there in 78 really, because I went to Colgate and started coming to visit Skidmore, it was threadbare as a community. And there was a period where the Racing Association, and there was movements to close Saratoga, and that Belmont was the shining jewel, and there were a couple of people involved, including Mary Lou Whitney, right. and I want to say Bernard Baruch, that basically said, no, we're not doing that, and this is historic, and it was really fortuitous, obviously, because then when the pendulum swung back, and it feels like, the pendulum obviously swung back, and Saratoga is in a glory era, and there's nothing's going to stop it, from going on from here. But it feels like Hot Springs is about a third of the way into that upswing back, and it all has to do with the Sellers, and everything that has happened here with the racetrack. It has just elevated, and the real estate development and everything else that's coming along with it. The best days are yet to come for this facility.
I've got friends of mine that used to go to Saratoga every year. In fact, they're on their way down here now, and they started coming here 3-4 years ago, maybe a couple of years before the COVID. But they now their vacation is coming to Oakland. One of the main reason is the economic part of it. It's so much cheaper to come here than it is there.
Yep.
But when they get here, the racing. I mean, they get a chance to. That's what they come for, is to play the races, and they get a chance here.
A lot of people don't realize also the history, the racing history behind this place. I mean, if I had a time travel capsule and I could go back in time, I think I would go back as a native of Hot Springs. I would go back to 1917, right, when racing kind of went away for a while because of a nationwide movement.
No, the blackout of gaming, only Maryland and Kentucky had any racing at all.
And it came back, I think, in 1917, sort of clandestinely, but it was wide open. I mean, and you're talking about, I mean, you had Essex Park on the other side of town. That was a very, very nice racetrack as well.
Wow.
And Oaklawn was, and Essex were running concurrent race meets. And back then, I mean, you're talking about there's a period of time there where at Oaklawn you had Panzeretta, Exterminator, Old Rosebud, Omar Khayyam was training here before he went on to win the Kentucky Derby. Top racing stables would come to Hot Springs, bring their horses by train. The racing secretary was John B. Campbell. He was 40 years old. He was considered to be a young racing secretary. Jack Campbell, they called him. And he would come to Hot Springs and stay here and then go to Essex.
Well, and of course, at the same time in that era, you also had what was going on with the baseball.
You had spring training here. Yeah. So you would have, you know, any given year, Cy Young, Ty Cobb, Babe Ruth.
Dizzy Dean and Dabney.
Lon Warnke, Rogers Hornsby had a baseball clinic here in Hot Springs. And there is a picture. It used to be hanging outside Charles Sella's office, but there's a picture of Babe Ruth, who used to jog the racetrack here, and come to gamble. But there's a picture of Babe Ruth on the Oaklawn racetrack sitting on a horse.
I've seen that. I've seen it as well. It's really cool. At Churchill, you got Muhammad Ali jogging, right. Jogging the track at the Downs too.
Right.
The baseball for baseball fans that haven't been here, there are the markers and a self-guided tour that you take that is just unbelievable. And my favorite is to go into Whittington Park, at the back end of Whittington Park where there's that crazy alligator farm, and in the Weyerhaeuser office. There's a home plate in the back corner of the parking lot that anecdotally was it Ruth that hit a home run that went into
right.
the alligator farm?
Arkansas alligator farm.
And because that's where the home plate in this parking lot of this Weyerhaeuser regional office. And that's where the stadium, there was a lump, Whittington Park. In fact, Marshall Graham named a horse Whittington Park.
Officially, the Arkansas Derby started in 1936, but it didn't. It actually started in Little Rock at a racetrack in Little Rock called, amazingly enough, Clinton Park.
Well, that's funny.
How about that?
That's funny.
And they had six or seven runnings of the Arkansas Derby at Clinton Park in Little Rock, and then it was falling into disrepair, and it got wiped out by a tornado. And the Sellas actually owned Clinton Park at that time. And then they moved. Oaklawn had just opened, and they moved the Arkansas Derby from Clinton Park in Little Rock to Hot Springs, and they ran four or five runnings of the Arkansas Derby in the old the Oaklawn Park in the early 1900s.
1904, right? It was the
I think they ran Arkansas Derby in 04, 05, 06, maybe 07 if they ran here.
And then the blackout started.
And then the blackout started, and they didn't resume the Arkansas Derby until 1936. But you don't see any of those in the record books.
No. You know,
the actual centennial of the Arkansas Derby was just a couple of years ago.
How funny is that?
And there were horses that they went to the Kentucky Derby from the Arkansas Derby back around the turn of the century. And even from Little Rock.
That's amazing. The Little Rock portion, I was unaware.
Yeah.
And I've read plenty of history.
And as far as the Oaklawn Essex Park thing, Essex Park was out on Lake Catherine, and it was considered to be about as nice as Oaklawn. And in 1917, Oaklawn was running a 10-day meet, and then right after that, the horses were going to go to Essex Park, and then right after that up to Memphis, Montgomery Park in Memphis. So they ran one day at Essex Park, okay? And the ownership of Essex Park had planned to rebuild the grandstand and make it a steel, nice steel grandstand. It was old rickety wood. But they postponed that plan because they thought they were going to get to run in the fall of 2016, which they didn't. So they went ahead and kept the old grandstand. They ran one day in 1917, right after Oakland ended, the very day after the Oakland meeting. Huge success. The next morning, the track burned. Yeah, burned to the ground. And the Sellas bought it later that year, 2017. Lewis Sella bought it, and they never raced there again.
So basically bought the dates, essentially.
Well, they moved the dates for that meet to Oakland.
Right.
Lewis Sella agreed that they could transfer everything to Oakland and go ahead and finish their meet at Oakland. But Essex Park was never rebuilt, and it, you know, never ran again.
Unbelievable.
So, yeah, it's pretty cool.
Randy Moss, that just you know, the history. It's funny how everybody here, Dave Hill, of course, the Vapors, the history, the appeal of the history of the town, and it's rather colorful history.
Oh yeah,
it's pretty infectious, and it's one of the things about coming here that that makes it, as Sandy, as you said, the kind of place where, you know, people want to come back and make it an annual event, and you know, then you fold in, you know, what is a increasingly vibrant dining scene, which racetrackers, you know, if racetrackers come, there better be good places to eat. So that contributes, and then, you know, you got a beautiful region to hike and experience, and, you know, obviously the national park.
I'm sure Randy remembers, but just think of the turnover of restaurants that they had here in town that were all mom and pop restaurants. So you could start on Whittington, or what's that turn into, where the Vapors is? What's that?
Park Avenue.
Right. And go from Park Avenue to the lake. And how many different really nice restaurants were there in the 80s two places? I mean, they were all
family
owned. They were no chains.
And the Vapors was a very popular nightclub out on Park Avenue, and it had some pretty big acts way back in the day. And as legend has it, the Vapors is where Tony Bennett first sang "I Left My Heart in San Francisco." You've probably heard that story as well. So there's, yeah.
Have you read Dave's book?
No.
You haven't read Dave's book?
No.
Oh my God! We'll get you. We'll you're going to be here all the next couple of days.
Yeah,
I will get a copy from his mom, from Pam, and you're. Oh my God! You're gonna love it. I can't believe. I'm shocked, actually. Have you met David over the years?
No.
Well,
I don't think I have. I'm really bad. You can ask my wife. Right. I'm really bad about that.
I will.
I probably met him 10 times.
I'm going to take it upon myself to somehow. He lives in New York, but maybe this summer at Saratoga they come up.
Pam run the sawmill. Pam Hill run the sawmill.
Oh God, the sawmill! I remember the sawmill. Oh my gosh.
Well, their family has. They've got a fun history themselves. The Hills.
Yeah. and of course, what's the son's name?
Dave.
Jim was the father, and they lost him for a few years back. But a good family. In fact, I stayed in one of their cabins at Buena Vista a few years. So,
for the season, you know, the whole gangster part of Hot Springs too, and even Oakland. I mean, they used to keep Oakland open after the racing meet in the 1930s, where the Capone horses would train on this track and get ready to be shipped out and be the subject of betting coups elsewhere. Right, and he would be his barn would be the only. It wasn't technically his barn, but it really the Denimarks. It really was the Capone horses. They had their own barn here that they. Yes, yeah, they built the barn. David Vance was in it for years.
Doug Davis.
Before that, it was the Denimark barn, and Denimark was a car dealer in Chicago, and they were connected with the Capone gang, as the story has it. And so they would, after the meet was over, only those horses would be able to stay at Oakland and train. And they would get them ready. No workouts, of course, published anywhere. And they would ship them out for betting coups at various ports around the country. Right. That
Lynn Whiting used to work at a lot of his horses day after the meet was over here because all the clockers were gone. But that was Lynn Whiting. If he thought he could get by on anybody,
it's your man, Lynn.
Everybody loves Lenny.
Oh, yeah, Lynn. Oh, my God.
It's now the Whitmore Barn.
Good for you.
Yeah, the Denmark Barn.
Oh, you're in the barn now?
Yeah.
Well, Ronnie, come over and come take. Yeah. No. Well, either of you. I would have given you the headset. Ron Moquette joining us as well. And Moquette's been listening in and nodding along. Sandy?
I'm not going anywhere.
All right, go.
No, that was the deal. Whenever I first got that barn from Mr. Vance, and before that it was Doug Davis, and I was intrigued with the history. I told everybody we was, you know, putting clay in the bottom of the barn. I said, y'all don't dig too far. Because I knew who owned
it. You didn't know what you might discover.
Yeah, I'm not wanting to be in a crime scene.
It'd be an archaeological dig. Well, it'd be dusting. Oh, my God.
Yeah, and I know you've talked about this, and it's probably in that book you're talking about, but this Hot Springs was the safe zone. You know, warring gangs from Chicago and elsewhere, mafia gangs, organized crime gangs, would come to Hot Springs for the thermal baths. And it was a truce. Nothing would happen while they were in Hot Springs. They'd be bitter enemies if they were back in Chicago or other places. But Hot Springs was the respite where they could come, and you wouldn't have any hanky-panky going on.
Well, Oney Madden.
Oney Madden. Although my father, as a young man, did actually see a mob hit in Hot Springs at a restaurant. But he, you know, fortunately he wasn't injured or anything, but he was in the restaurant when it took place.
Which restaurant?
It was in Freeman Center. There was a restaurant. It's right down Central Avenue here. There used to be a nice restaurant. I don't remember the name of it. And then when Oney Madden died, my father was walking by the house because he was a very popular figure in Hot Springs. He had done a lot for the city of Hot Springs after he retired, and he lived up on Park Avenue. And when he died, there were a lot of people that just kind of sightseers when word came out that he had died. And for people listening that don't know him, Oney Madden was a infamous gangster back in the 30s. And so when my dad went to the house with a buddy of his, just to, I guess, pay their respects or whatever, there were a bunch of boxes sitting on the curb. They were cleaning out the house. And my dad and his friend went over, and the boxes were filled with photographs.
Oh, wow.
Of Oney Madden and all of his friends.
Wow.
And who knows who.
I would love to see that.
And they were throwing them away. And my dad and his friend thought briefly, I wonder if we should just take these boxes. And they decided against it.
Ooh.
And they were they were just taken to the dump.
Well, yeah. And I'm sure, you know, tons of, because Madden ran nightclubs, ran the Cotton Club, I think.
Now, who knows what were in those boxes?
Yeah. That would have been historical if you could have nabbed those.
What was your dad's business? How did
The family business was and still is pharmacy. Ironically, I actually was in pharmacy school at one point.
Were you really?
I got pressured into pharmacy school.
Did you go to Arkansas?
Where University of Arkansas.
University of Arkansas.
Yeah. So I spent one semester in pharmacy school before I made a not so graceful exit.
Well, wait a minute.
That was very disconcerting to my parents. But
you've done all right. But more importantly, you got to call the Hawks for us. I've never asked you to call the Hawks.
Oh, but.
Usually Danny Pites usually is the
Pites. We're Pig Suey.
This is one of those that elusive Eclipse Award I'm looking for, is having Randy Moss call
just,
the Hawks.
You can just imagine me call the Hawks.
No.
I've done it many times. I was at Barnhill Arena back in the day when they introduced Lou Holtz to the student body. I was there.
Oh my God.
When I went to college when the Triplets played. Sidney Moncrief, Marvin Delph, and Ron Brewer.
I have a horse named Moncrief right now.
You have a horse named Moncrief?
Yeah.
Wow.
I named
Eddie
him after
Sutton
the Triplets.
Back then.
Unbelievable.
So those were heady days, you know, for Arkansas football and Arkansas basketball.
So while we have such a good historian here.
Say the least.
Am I a historian?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, you're a historian. Because everything that I've read, you basically just spit out very eloquently and accurately. But, okay, so my house is right there. You can see it, right? What's the deal with the race at Oaklawn banner? The war between the bookie and the Sellers?
Do you remember the...
The place on in back?
Yeah, that's my house now.
Okay, with the bamboo?
Yes.
Well, I can tell you a little bit about that because I got hauled into court over that, actually.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, what? Back in the very early 1980s. Now, you know, think about this, and people who are old enough will remember it. In the pre-internet days, there was a very strict rule about making phone calls from a racetrack.
Sure.
Because of bookmaking.
Fast posting.
They would lock the phones up.
They would lock the phones up, right? And there was a sort of a cottage industry at racetracks around the country of bookmakers in the racetrack taking books. Well, there was a gentleman, there was a trainer and an owner and a breeder in Arkansas that was at Oaklawn Park named Gomer Evans, who was accused of making book in the grandstand and was barred from coming into the track. So... Lo and behold, right behind the track at about the 5/8 pole,
yeah,
a big metal, ugly metal building on stilts was erected. And you could stand on the balcony at the top of the building and you could watch the races. And there were people with binoculars up there watching the races. So Oaklawn security had a picture of Gomer Evans, the bookmaker, the accused bookmaker, standing on top with binoculars watching the races. So it's private property. There's really not a lot Oaklawn could do. So they planted fast-growing bamboo in front of the structure, right on the outside rail. And it's I didn't know it at the time, but bamboo apparently grows at an amazing rate of speed.
Very quick.
And so in a short period of time, they completely blocked the view of anyone in that building. And
unbelievable.
And so I wrote about it in the newspaper.
Oh, my God.
The whole shebang, right? And it was a very ugly facility, and it was nicknamed the Green Monster.
Oh, how funny.
Fenway Park. So I wrote that it was, colloquially called the Green Monster, So anyway, they sue Oaklawn for blocking their view with the bamboo, right? And I got subpoenaed.
What year is this?
Oh, it's got to be 1982, maybe 83, something like that. Yeah. Was it later than that?
Yeah, I think it was 84.
So I'm supposedly testifying in court here in Garland County on behalf of the people who built the structure. So I get on the stand, and their lawyer starts going at me, I mean, tooth and nail. Green Monster, who do you think you are? Where'd you come up with that? Green Monster. How could you call it the Green Monster? Where did you get that name? I'm like, are you doing anything about baseball? I didn't make up the Green Monster. Fenway, And eventually the judge said, sir, it looks to me like you're interrogating your own witness. Do you have any more questions for this young man? No. And they lost the case.
What paper were you writing for?
At the time, the Arkansas Gazette.
The Gazette.
And then I went from the Gazette to the Democrat. It was a huge newspaper war.
Sure.
And I was sort of in the middle of the newspaper war.
He was the prized possession of whoever had that had the intel on racing. So there was a huge... There was a lot of hard feelings over him not staying at the Centennial. They want him to go back.
They had TV production companies come in. I was doing TV commercials. They had me on the side of buses, billboards, bus stop benches.
I actually saw
That's great.
I had a picture of a bench that was for sale somewhere that I was trying to get it bought.
Really?
Where you're still on the picture. Yeah.
Because back in the day, Steve, you can imagine... so much money was being betted on the park.
Yeah.
No simulcasting, $3 million a day handle on track in 1983.
Wow.
And a lot of rich Texans coming in here betting a ton of money. And it was a relatively uneducated betting crowd compared to like what you would find in New York and all that. And I was doing speed figures in 1983 and handicapping for the newspaper based on speed figures. And nobody in this part of the country had speed figures.
Nope. But nobody had them other than the speed boys.
And they thought I was some kind of genius. They thought I was some kind of handicapping savant. Because you'd be picking these horses that were 8-1 in the program that logically should have been 8-5. right? And, you know, I was showed. I'd show a flat bet profit in the newspaper.
So did you cover the match race with Gomer Evans and John Starr?
Yeah, I didn't cover it, but I was watching it from a box.
That was
It was John Starr and Gomer Evans.
Yeah.
It was after the last race in the meet, which has always been the Trails End, mile and three quarters. And there was a big crowd that stayed around because I guess John Starr, who's an Arkansas breeder and ran the sale in Little Rock every year. I don't know if he still does. Maybe
No, he did.
Is he still alive?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess he ran track at one point.
And they were they had an argument which turned into a bet, which turned into John Starr has to carry weight on his back.
They ran 1 mile against each other around the oval. There were 1,000 people that hung around after the last race after the Arkansas Derby, right? The Trails End, and to watch this race. A lot of money was at stake. And John Starr wore a life preserver that was weighted with the same weights you would put in a horse's saddle pouch.
Dead weight.
I don't remember how much weight it was.
It was a pound for every age difference, was it?
I don't remember.
Holtus told me the story, and it was like, it said it looked like Secretariat in the Belmont.
It did. Gomer was basically eased.
Banned and on a list.
Playing over here that said the guy's name from Oklahoma.
Will Rogers never met Charles Seller.
Oh, that was probably Gomer Evans.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Gomer Evans, what Sandy's talking about. Gomer Evans on Derby Day had hired a banner driver for an airplane, and there was a deal going around. It was on TV. It said Will Rogers never met a man he didn't like. Well, after the lawsuit that you was in, he rented an airplane and said, Will Rogers never met Charles Sellers. And it went around all on Derby Day.
Oh, my gosh.
But that's
that's
the stuff that I'm interested in. I actually have one of the dinner plates out of the jockey club for the Essex Park.
Wow.
So I found that and snatched it up in a local story.
So there was a jockey that rode here in the early 1900s named Herman Radtke, Radtke. He was of I think German descent, and he was the riding superstar of America. He was batting almost 40% at Oaklawn. And now this was back in the day when there weren't that many top stables at Oaklawn. And the ones that were here pretty much dominated the racing here. And Radtke rode first call for those stables, and he was on mostly heavy favorites, you know, in seemingly every race. But reading accounts of this guy, he was just unbelievable. And it was national news. I mean, not only did the burning of Essex Park make the New York Times and all the top newspapers around the country, but Herman Radtke was very well known around the country. He went to New York right after Oaklawn to ride at the New York tracks, and it was a big deal. But he was apparently a real hothead, and he was being suspended constantly, getting in fights with the jockeys, getting in verbal altercations with the stewards, and apparently he enjoyed the lifestyle in New York a little too much. And his career wound up kind of crashing and burning after a while when he went up to New York. He wound up going to Russia to ride along with Jimmy Winkfield for some of the czars and all that in Russia. But yeah, Herman Radtke was the earliest. He was the Pat Day of the early 1900s at
were you here
at Oaklawn Park?
I wouldn't have been able to bet him then either, because I could never get Pat Day right.
Were you here with Garth Patterson,
Deputy Dog?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
So Jimmy Garrute tells the story.
My
about
next door neighbor, by the way,
Jimmy Garrute. He says that Garth Patterson was a crier. Like when he'd get off the horse, he'd be crying, and he was so emotional. He'd be like, you know, he was a funny guy, but he was wear his emotions on his sleeve, and he would say, Jimmy, you got to put blinkers on this horse. We're never going to win till you put blinkers on him. And then he'd say, Garth, he had blinkers. He said, well, take them off, man.
When the money was down, these guys went after Garth Patterson.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Sandy. Yeah. I mean, he was a clutch money rider. Oh, my gosh. Not just, I mean, Lynn Whiting would use him sometimes when the money was down. He and Larry Melanson.
Yeah.
Yeah, they, if you remember, Garth, when the feature race here every day, that's when we were running Monday through Saturday, when the feature race here every day, might have been the only race he rode every day. Was, but he didn't ride many, but when he was on them.
Craig Perrett style.
Yeah.
I don't know why
yeah.
they called him Deputy Dog. Had to do with the cartoon. It was his yeah. favorite cartoon, yeah. and I guess they just yeah. nicknamed him Deputy Dog.
What about him and Rainey? Had them parrots. They had them parrots, the talking parrots, and they were both lived in Airstreams. And that's quite a story, too, with those two guys, because they were a little different. But they had a lot of fun, but they were both really good riders. Of course, Tony got hurt here on the
right, yeah, he got his arm paralyzed, yeah.
He's still training now. I see you around Cleveland. I see his name pop up every once in a while.
There's a picture downstairs that's on the stairwell that looks like that Peb drew Anthony Rainey coming out of the gates because of his elongated nose. Yeah. It looks just like Tony Rainey.
He was first call for Bob Holthus for quite a while. Yeah, Tony Rainey and Bob were,
A voice deep, looked like it ought to go to a 7-foot man, and his little bitty Tony Rainey. Turn around, it's like, sound like Satan himself saying good morning, and turn around, and it's a guy 3 foot tall. Who's the best horse you've ever seen run here?
Alvador.
See,
prettiest horse I ever saw in my life to this day.
Yeah.
Him in the infield being saddled for the Oakland Handicap that year. Was just spectacular. And Easy Goer might be the second best looking horse I think I've ever seen.
All right, what's the
best? You know, his son. I mean,
what's the best matchup you've ever seen here?
Oh God, Ron. You know, I don't know. There's been so many of them here. One of my favorite stories from way back in the day. So there was the Fantasy Stakes back then was run on Saturday before the Arkansas Derby, the Saturday before. And the Fantasy used to be, the prep for a time for the Kentucky Oaks. And Wayne Lucas sent in Althea, and Laz Barrera sent in a beautiful filly named My Darling One, who was very successful in California. Had a lot of white, you know.
White on her belly.
Beautiful filly.
Yeah.
And they both had really good form in California, and this was a really big matchup. And Pat Valenzuela came in. I don't remember. Maybe Pinkai was on the other one. I don't know who was on Althea. I mean, Pat Valenzuela was on Althea.
And I think you're right. I think it was Pinkai on My Darling One.
So they left the gate, and Althea went to her nose. And she was a speed horse, and she's dead last going in the first turn. And the rail was open, and turning into the back stretch, here comes Althea charging up the rail, you know, headstrong to get to the front, and they shut the door on her. And Valenzuela had to check, and she goes back to last, and she steers to the outside, and she comes around, and she hooks up with My Darling One at about the 3/8 pole, and they go head and head from the 3/8 pole, opened up about 10 or 12 lengths on the field. And My Darling One edges away from Althea at the end and beats her by about 3/4 of a length or a length, right? In today's numbers, the buyer's speed figure would have come back like a 105. With Althea stumbling at the start and getting checked going into the turn. I'm riding for the Thoroughbred Record back then. So I go to the barn the next day to talk to Wayne. Even back then, Wayne was very aggressive with his spotting of his horses, right? And so I said, is there any chance you would run Althea back in the Arkansas Derby? And he said, no. No, I'm not going to run her in the Arkansas Derby. So I wrote for the Thoroughbred Record. You know, Wayne Lucas said he's not running. And lo and behold, Thursday, he enters Althea in the Arkansas Derby. So I go back to Wayne on Friday morning, and I said, Wayne, what's the deal? And he's smiling. And I said, you told me. I wrote it. I was in the Thoroughbred Record. You're not running in the Arkansas Derby. I said, why did you tell me that? And he said, I didn't want you guys hanging around the barn all week. You know, so she was running against Gate Dancer. She was running against At the Threshold, who wound up being third in the Kentucky Derby.
And the sire of Little E.T.
There were a couple of other horses in there that were really top horses, and I thought she was a freaking cinch. There was no speed in the race, so she was going to control the pace. She was coming off like this 105 buyer with all the trouble that she had, and no other horse in the race had ever run faster than 100 at that time. And she goes to the lead and wins by 7.
Straight in.
Sets a record that I think she's still got the mile and eighth track record here. 1984. Yeah. Yeah. And of course, 2 weeks later, he ran her in the Kentucky Derby, and she wasn't the soundest horse in the world, and that didn't end well. So, Yeah, she was blast, I think. But anyway, that's one of my...
That's Helen Alexander, I think, in the Gross family.
Yes, yes. And she wound up being, you know, that female family. It continues to this day. You go back and look at some of those third dams, you know.
King Ranch.
Yep.
King Ranch.
Exactly. Anyway, a lot of stories.
This is gold for someone that loves horse racing and loves Oaklawn. This ought to be an annual deal.
This is almost heresy. Talking about Alidar, it's almost heresy to say, but it was a handicap, Oaklawn handicap, and he was giving a lot of weight to the field. But he hooks up at the top of the stretch with a Green Tree stable horse named San Juan Hill, and they go affirmed in Alidar all the way down the stretch. That might be the best matchup I've ever seen. Head and head, nose and nose. And if he could have gone by, Alidar wouldn't go by. And San Juan Hill beats him in a photo. And to this day, I think back on that race, and I think back on affirmed in Alidar, and I wonder how much of that was affirmed's legendary determination, or how much of it was Alidar being a horse that maybe didn't want a dogfight.
Wow.
Wanted to run with another horse that was fighting back and didn't necessarily want to go by.
Yeah, wow. Well,
you know? That's kind of interesting now when you think about that in hindsight.
Well, I always thought that was a...
I think it was Gaver.
Yeah, Donnie Brumfield rode San Juan Hill.
Okay.
I think that's one of the things that made Cigar so legendary and better was the fact that he would, whenever a horse would come up to him, they'd look at him with that eye and he'd just keep on going. And it seemed like whatever time Cigar wanted to go, if the track was fast and he wanted to go 143 for a mile and 16th, he would just do it. Those horses couldn't pass him. And I always thought that he just had that dog in him that they didn't want to fight him.
That was 1979 when Alidar ran here. And in the 1980s, I thought it was the heyday of Oaklawn that we'd never see again, you know, because the on-track fueled every racetrack. And Oaklawn had unbelievable on-track. The purses here were better than any place except Southern California and New York, and they were close to those. Way better than Gulfstream, way better than Fairgrounds, way better than Kentucky. Woody Stevens would bring a little string in here every year toward the end of the meet. Bobby Frankel had a little small string here 1 year for the whole meet.
Mr. Bishop was strong, though.
W.T. Bishop. I was sitting 1 year here in the press box. There you go, San Juan Hill. John Gaver, Jr., okay.
Green Tree, wasn't it? Green Tree?
So Steve called up his career record here on the computer, so what we're looking at.
Look what it did to him. He got this.
Ninth, eighth, and sixth, the next three starts for San Juan Hill after the Oaklawn Handicap. Wow.
In good races, too, in the Rose Bend, in the Metropolitan, and in the Mascot.
So one story I told here yesterday, I think it was 1983. Three, maybe. We're in the press box right now at Oakland. If I had a dollar for every hour I spent here in the press, I used to have a key to the grandstand. But down here, a little further in the press box, I'm sitting there, and there's a horse running in an allowance race at Oakland Park. Last race on the card. And his name was Exile King. He only had two or three starts. And he was coming from Gulfstream Park, owned by C.V. Whitney. And he had just run second in an allowance race at Gulfstream Park. And this is in early April, late March. And it was kind of starting to get dark. I remember that was a Saturday. And nobody knew the horse at the time that he finished second to in the allowance race at Gulfstream Park. Conquistador Cielo. And he's out on the board. He's like 7-2. And we're all sitting in the press box, and we're wondering. You know, nobody knew who Conquistador was. Because back then, you didn't have simulcasting. You didn't really know these horses at other tracks that well. And we're thinking, should we bet on this horse at 7-2? Is he well-meant? There was another really good horse in there. Joe Canty had a horse in there that was really good. And we don't know if we should bet on him or not, you know. And it's like 3 or 4 minutes to post, and the door opens to the press box. C.V. Whitney comes strolling through the press box.
Yeah, you bet.
There was a stampede to the betting window in the press box.
Yeah, you bet.
There was a line of about 10 people at the window to bet on Exile King. He just aired. Hey, he was...
Elliot Birch.
Trained Exile King?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So this is...
There's the allowance race. April 6th, 1983. And he came back and ran third in his next start in the Arkansas Derby. But, no, it was March 22nd because the... The race before.
There's the Gulf. The Gulfstream race was the maiden breaker.
Okay, well, I guess he beat Conquistador Cielo then in the allowance race at Gulfstream Park. Yeah, and then he came here and won two in a row. Yeah.
So you talked about the key to the grandstand.
They look just like that.
Don't let Bert strain.
That's yeah. Bob Holtus give me that. Whenever he started getting sick, he said, "Here, I've told Eric that you need this in case I can't get here. We got to get, you know." He told me what to open, and but Bob Holtus give me that key, and I've carried it everywhere I go. And it does open like four doors left through all the construction.
I was just asking Jason Milligan last night. I said, "I wonder if I used to have a key to the grandstand. I wonder if it would still work." And it looked exactly like that.
That's it. It's got four.
I probably still got it somewhere.
Yeah, it's got four.
Don't tell anybody.
Four doors to the outside. That's
right.
The only thing. It you know, with the casino, they've changed a lot of locks.
Wow. Holy cow. Well, my wife has been so nice. I don't know if she's still hanging around up here or not. But
we're gonna head back and get out of here.
Yeah, I better take off.
But,
it was awesome catching up with you guys, man. It's unreal.
Let me do this. Let me send it to a break. Casey, let's break and so I can get a picture of the guys together. And we'll come back. Hour three, thanks to Randy Moss, Ron Moquette, Sandy Montgomery. Stay with us.
At the races with Steve Beck on Sirius XM Radio. Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action in thorough horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Pons family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and curly stands, the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, divining rod by Tappan.